I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. And being the first TechNet of the year, maybe something has changed on the computer, on this machine, and therefore things will be different. We'll soon find out. The TechNet meets most Sunday evenings for the purpose of amateur radio operators trading information with each other as to usually technical subjects, sometimes non-technical. In other words, the politics or the regulatory portion of ham radio. Guys ask each other questions on the subject of how do I optimize my antenna and my transmitter and my receiver and my feed line and propagation and what bands. And there's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio. Lots to be learned. The wireless, the whole field of wireless technology is only partially taught in the schools from my point of view. A lot of improvement can take place. You really want somebody who understands radio, you hire a ham radio operator, one that's enthusiastic and he's been doing it in his backyard for 10 years, so to speak. That's where the real experience and the real knowledge is coming from in many cases. Let me drop. I noticed that when I drop the machine for a short period of time, it doesn't always come back until you drop it for a particular period of time. Got to get used to the new settings there, apparently. If Eric, KE2EJ, or KC2, let me think now, Andy, W2CDL, these guys can probably check on the operation when they get informed about the way it's behaving today. A person signs into the technical net by giving me and John, KC2WGV, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. The way things work is that during the first hour, we take check-ins with people giving us their name, the call letters, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. We make a sincere effort to answer all of those questions, at least briefly, during the first hour. In theory, you never have to wait more than an hour to at least get the first brief answer. At the end of that hour, John will be reading us the emails that he has received from new amateurs that are don't yet have their license, don't have the ability to easily get on the air and communicate directly with us. So by way of snail mail, email, and whatever, and by way of the website that's being set up at Limark, if you go to limark.org, you'll find out about Mel's website that you can sign into with your questions and comments. There's also another website you can sign into if you hear disruptive information. In other words, let me drop. When you hear signals that you think shouldn't be there, we ask you to press the reverse button on your transceiver so that you can hear the input frequency. Record what the S-meter says. In other words, is the guy S1 or S9 or 20 over 9? And report that to the interference website that's been set up at limark.org. And that way we can slowly pin down where the interference is coming from. As I said, at the end of the hour, John will read us two, three, or four, depending on how many universal-type questions he's got from the beginning amateurs. If Paul's available, that's WS2N. He's our space expert. He'll be telling us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. After that first hour and a half, hour and three-quarter, then we get into the deeper subjects. There's an ongoing experiment that John, Wesley, and others are doing, and they, I believe, will be presenting to you websites you can go to where you can see the actual schematic diagram of what they're doing with, and in some cases, some actual YouTube videos. And Bernie K2 Yankee Oscar is the guy who is providing that service. I seem to remember last week he gave us his email address by which you can get a copy. I thought I had it on my list here.
Bernie@huntfamily.com.
John, do you want to spell that out? Bernie at huntfamily.com. Spell that out one slowly, John. Go ahead.
Just like the name, Bernie at Hunt, H-U-N-T, family.com. And it works. The site is up and running, so he'll get the message.
Okay, so by that means, you can find out the latest schematic diagram of what Wesley and John are working with. Wesley also has some YouTube videos in which he shows you the actual construction of his elaborate machine. And it's not a neat construction. I'm kind of amazed at the amount of effort that went into what I think are rather thick pieces of fiberboard is not the right word for it. Plywood with hinges and so on. I also saw in the latest movie a very high power, approximately 1 microfarad homemade capacitor made out of sheets of foil and plastic, with all held together in with nylon bolts. Very neat construction, quite an elaborate thing. So we'll be hearing more about that much later on in the TechNet. So right now, once again, we're going to be taking check-ins. Happy New Year, you guys. We'll take check-ins by people giving me the call letters, the name, and the word yes at this time. K2RIW, we're listening.
2MDT, Steve, and yes.
James, yes.
Okay, I heard Steve and James. James, I remember signed in from last week. Didn't hear your call at that time. But, my goodness, am I forgetful. And where on my list did I put him last week? Huh? Was it, yeah, I think it was KD2 Baker Hotel Yankee. Is that correct, James? Yeah, one of the problems we're having is that I'm going to do an experiment right now where I drop the machine and see if I can pick it up immediately, and I think sometimes it does not. Yeah, I see that we, after you drop the machine, you have to drop it for a certain length of time, otherwise it doesn't pick up again. I'm going to assume that I've got James correct, KD2BHY. We got Steve and James so far. When I drop the machine now, wait a full 4 seconds before you give me the next check-in. That way we should be able to hear you. K2RIW listening for the next check-in. Wait 4 seconds before you give it a carrier. Okay, I didn't hear any other check-in. Let's try one more time just to make sure we're not missing anybody. Yeah, that whole last transmission you made, Wes, I heard you on the input, but none of it came through the machine. So there's a peculiar operation where when the carrier is dropped, it looks like most of the time the carrier has to be dropped for a full 4 or 5 seconds, then the machine will pick up. If you pick up within the first 2 or 3 seconds, you can make a transmission as long as you want. I'm hearing you on the input, but nothing came through. So I think you said that something like 7 minutes before the TechNet is when the machine went into this peculiar mode of operation. Looks like we're going to have to work around that before Andy or Eric get a chance to fix it. So when Andy or Eric do come along, we'll tell them that the 4 tones are not there. The machine completely drops the carrier. And when you do drop the carrier, if you don't drop it, if you don't drop it for 4 or 5 seconds, then the next time somebody picks up, the machine does not repeat. So it's in a peculiar mode of operation. Let me, it's too bad most of you guys cannot hear whether or not you're coming through the machine. See, I'm running in the full duplex mode. I can hear what's coming out of the machine at the same time I'm transmitting, and I'm wearing earphones. Otherwise, you'd be hearing a feedback. I held the microphone near the earphones, and it didn't break into oscillation. Kind of amazed by that one. Okay, Steve, do wait for a full 5 seconds, and then proceed with your question. KC2MDP, after 5 seconds of wait, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Happy New Year to you and to everyone on the TechNet. Tonight my question concerns, I have two UHF antennas. Basically, they're set up for Oscar satellite reception. So the antennas are for about center cut, I would say about 435. And I have them phased so I could use either right-hand or left-hand circular polarization. Now, what I want to basically do is use this antenna for D-Star. So I want to bring it up. I want to use it, I guess, maybe center frequency, probably around 445, I would say. Now, the problem I'm having is the SWR goes through the loop. It's about a 3-to-1 when I go up to 445. I was thinking of using an antenna tuner. I can get an antenna tuner for UHF. But my only question is, how efficient is this antenna going to be, you know, being with the phasing harness and everything, which is cut to the 435 meg band? Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Looks like it did pick up right now, and I heard everything you said. When you do say that the right hand and left hand circular polarization of two UHF antennas, the Catani knows, I can't remember, KH6 something or other, call letters of the guy from AMSAT, had an antenna where there's a horizontal bar, you got a vertically polarized antenna on the left side, horizontally polarized antenna on the right side. Those are the two 435 mega antennas. And as you wave that array back and forth, it does, because one antenna is moved forward and the other antenna is moved back, you do slant to various kinds of circular polarization, and it's maybe that's the antenna you're talking about. In either case, I think you say your antenna is giving you a fairly nice VSWR at 435, but a fairly poor, like 3-to-1 VSWR at 445 megacycles. And there's two or three things going on there, and the word efficiency has a front. You'll find the article by KQRIW on impedance matching a dipole or impedance matching the driven element of a Yagi. That particular article will tell you how to retune the driven element at 435 megs. And therefore, when you retune it by series, a parallel capacitor across the feed point, you will, by following that article and following the suggested step-by-step, really need to be held by the hand that much. You'll figure it out. You'll be able to really low standing wave ratio at 435, or 445 megacycles. That's a given. You can do that. And doing that at the antenna is a very desirable thing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay. It came back in a hurry this time. Doing that, making each individual antenna all by itself at 445 megs, is the first step in the process of making a good antenna. Now, because the driven element has a real good standing wave ratio, by definition, the antenna will give you a high efficiency. In other words, of all the power that goes into it, it's going to be radiated somewhere into space. Whether or not your parasitic elements, your directors, are the right lens to give you the same pattern, that's a little bit in doubt, but there's various ways you can confirm the pattern by looking at the sun, looking at a satellite, aiming at the horizon and sweeping it across the ham radio operator signal at 445 megs or a repeater at 445. There's various ways you can confirm the pattern. And if you're unhappy with the pattern, then the next step, when you get the time for it, will be to retune the director string. And most likely, the directors might have to be shortened a certain percentage by the ratio of 435 to 445 megacycles would be the first step. Leave them in the right positions, just shorten their length a little bit. Some retuning of the driven element might be required, but you don't have to do that right away. Your highest priority is to first get a good VSWR on each driven element. If each driven element is now giving you, let me pick a number, a 1.3-to-1 standing wave ratio or better, now your phasing harness with very rare exceptions, your phasing harness will automatically work. Most phasing harnesses are extremely broadband. In other words, the fact that you may have set it up for 432, you used it at 435 at one time and using it at 445 now, very minor a problem as far as the phasing harness is concerned. Also, if it's the Catani nose technique where one antenna is on each end of a horizontal bar that you can now swing in azimuth, automatically you can get all possible phase angles of that signal as you swing it back and forth.
Repeater.
Those two antennas now constitute a kind of an interferometer. So, I wonder if that made some sense so far, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it did, Dick. It made a lot of sense. But basically what I want to do is I really don't want to touch the antennas because I still want to use the satellite. But let's just put it this way. I got way too much stuff up there, and to put another separate antenna, UHF, Yagi or whatever up there for the D-Star is just kind of it's not out of the question, but you know, I'd have to do some major work up there, so I figured an easy way would just be using an antenna tuner. I know MFJ makes a UHF antenna tuner. I looked it up. I was just wondering, you know, with the phasing harness and everything else, would it be as effective as if I would just put up a single UHF antenna for 445. Back to you.
Putting up a single antenna for 445 is a way to go. retuning your current Yagi or Yagis for 45 is another very desirable way to go. When you study the way the swept frequency response of almost any UHF Yagi operates, you'll discover that when you plot standing wave ratio vertically and frequency horizontally, you'll see that as you go up in frequency, let's plot gain of performance. Plot gain of performance vertical versus frequency horizontal. You'll see that the change in performance of the antenna as you go up in frequency is a very gentle slope at first. Then you hit some particular critical frequency, which is sort of like a cliff, and it dives. The Vizwar jumps real high, the gain jumps real low. In other words, Yagi's, when you go above the design frequency, you get in trouble. When you go below the design frequency, they work very well. It's an extremely slow fall off in performance as you go down in frequency. That's the reason I'm recommending that you retune each individual Yagi for 445 or a compromised frequency, 442, something like that. Retune them for, let's say, 442 megacycles. Then the performance will be beautiful at 445. It'll be beautiful at 435. Even when you go all the way down to 432, it'll only be a couple of percent lower. But going down in frequency on a Yagi from its tuned frequency, they tend to behave very well. Just that they got this cliff effect as you go up high. And so correcting them at the Yagi position themselves so that you can use them on all of your services, that's a very desirable way to go. Let me drop. I'm putting the antenna tuner in the shack after, let me pick a number, 30, 40, 60 feet of feed line on 440. Yes, you can do that, and you'll make the transmitter happy in the shack. But still, that piece of transmission line will be running at the 3-to-1 Vizwar in your particular example. You go to the right curve that's in the ARRL antenna book, and it might even be in the radio amateur's handbook, where they show you what is the rate of increase of insertion loss of a transmission line depending on what standing wave ratio it is feeding. And you may find out that in your particular case, the dB loss of your transmission line is going to be double the number of dB because of the 3-to-1 Vizwar at the far end. So although you can correct the Vizwar in the shack as far as what the transmitter sees, you're still going to be suffering a lot of loss of that cable on both transmit and receive. So correcting it at the antenna has got a lot going for it. The antenna tuner at UHF is a fairly rare item, and you can sort of see why. On HF frequencies, where the feed line tends to be much lower, you could have a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, use the antenna tuner in the shack, and you still get 90-some-odd% of the performance. On UHF, that tends not to be true. So if you don't already own the antenna tuner and you're about to go out and buy it, I'd go a little slow on that one and try some of these other experiments first, Steve. And to do the experiment is non-destructive. In other words, if it doesn't work at first, it's not going to catch on fire, it's not going to explode. But tuning the antenna itself to a compromised frequency, like 442 megacycles, I think it's going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar. And tuning each one of the antennas, it's only the driven element I'm talking about at first. It's going to be a half-hour procedure for you once you read that article. It's a well-kept secret up till now, if you know what I mean, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. Yes, you've answered my question beautifully. Once again, I thank you for the information.
Hey, you come back and let us know how this all worked out. Now, before we go over to Jim, I did hear another person checking in. Maybe he was checking in by way of Echolink or IRLP. But who was that other person checking in? Wait for about 5 seconds before you respond, and then tell us who you are. K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe not. I thought there was another person checking in between two of Steve's transmissions. Jim, is that satellite work? So I wonder how that project is going, James. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee. A man who I think has his ham license for about 2 weeks. K2RIW. You got it, Jim.
Yep, around 2 weeks now. But my question today would be about sporadic E. Now, I read a little bit about sporadic E, but there wasn't much information. I mean, really, what is sporadic E? Like, I know there's something that goes on in the lower levels of the ionosphere that makes it so higher frequencies can bounce off the ionosphere. But what if you could give me in words specifically, is sporadic E, and have you ever experienced sporadic E?
Yes, I have. On quite a few occasions, I've experienced it, James. Ordinarily, the ionosphere, what is the maximum usable frequency? It's primarily determined by what the sunspot cycle is doing. During the time you got a whole lot of sunspots, I think the sun is at that time putting out a lot of extra ultraviolet radiation. The ultraviolet radiation hits the atmosphere, ionizes various layers. In other words, it breaks up the individual air molecules into free electrons, and the nucleus is left over. That's the ionized material. It's a conductive material. So at various levels, the D layer is a certain altitude, a little higher than that's the E layer, and there's the F layer, a little higher yet. And at nighttime, there's a F1 and an F2. But at these various levels of the ionosphere, depending on how much ionization they get, they will favor certain frequencies. You might find out that at a low sunspot cycle period, and there's not very many sunspots, maybe 40 meters is the highest band that's open, and 20 meters opens occasionally. You take the peak of the sunspot cycle, and you find that 20, 15, and 10 meters are open every day, and occasionally 6 meters are open. So that's the normal characteristic of sunspots and maximum usable frequency. Along comes these strange clouds that I believe usually peak in late May, early June, and then again it occurs in the beginning of December. The sporadic E clouds don't follow the sunspot cycle per se. It's something very unusual about them. They think they're weather caused. Almost all of these sporadic E clouds are only a few miles in diameter. They start somewhere in the southern Atlantic Ocean. They sweep toward the northwest. They usually move at 150 miles an hour, and they're usually only a
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
They're usually only a few miles in diameter. As I say, they usually start for some strange region in the southern Atlantic. They move toward the northwest, which you could say on a good day they start off at Florida, sweep across the middle of the United States, and exit from Washington State or the Vancouver area. They move toward the northwest at something like 150 miles an hour. These sporadic E clouds are, for some reason, very highly ionized. They will reflect 10 meters, 6 meters, quite often 2 meters, and on a small number of occasions, 432. So normally the maximum usable frequency doesn't go anywhere near that high during that portion of the sunspot cycle. The sporadic E clouds, occasionally there's a bunch of them separated by, you know, 1,000 miles maybe, I'm not quite sure, but sometimes they come in groups. But if you know where the propagation is occurring, in other words, if you aim your antenna to the southwest and a sporadic E cloud happens to be over Tennessee, I'm not exactly sure of the geometry, but let's assume that at this instant of time there's one over Tennessee giving you a beautiful reflection between Long Island and Texas. So assume Tennessee in my example is at the midpoint, and that's the point of reflection of the sporadic E cloud, and on 10 meters or on 6 meters you're hearing a gangbuster signal coming from Texas, and it's there for about 15, 20, maybe 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And then the guy from Texas fades out. But you know that the cloud, by looking at your map and figuring out you're talking to Texas, you make a guess that the sporadic E cloud was over Tennessee, in my example. And you know that they always move to the northwest at 150 miles an hour. You can guess where the next opening's going to occur. And maybe the next opening's going to be in Colorado, because that's the way the geometry works. You know where the cloud is moving, and you know where the next opening is going to occur, and you know what to look for. And you aim your antenna a little bit more clockwise. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I wish I knew a good website that gives a lot better explanation of this. There's a man in Upper New York State who became a silent key, who did tremendous amounts of investigation of sporadic E clouds for at least half of a lifetime. If I could think of his call letters and his name, in fact, there's a... The Central States VHF Society has created an award in his honor for people who use sporadic E and do other VHF advances. So if we do check into the Central States VHF Society website, I think the man's name was Mel. Anyhow, he's a guy who lives in Upper New York State. You'll find out the name of his website, his award, and his call letters. That'll help you those will be the search words, his call letters and his name. Wilson. Slowly coming back to me. I think his name was Mel Wilson. If you do a search on Sporadic E plus Wilson, guarantee you're going to find a number of articles that he has written. You may want to do that search also through QST magazine. Get a number of QST articles on the subject. Once you find the right article, and if you're not successful in finding it, I'll do a little bit of a search myself during the week. We'll find you some articles on Sporadic E. You'll find it's quite exciting, and you get some very strong signals for brief periods of time over very long ranges at a time in the sunspot cycle when you ordinarily wouldn't get good propagation. So it's a fun thing to experiment with. 6 meters, 10 meters, and occasionally 2 meters are where it really works very well. So maybe that's some of the information, James. Drag your feet a little bit in case we got some other Sporadic E experts on frequency that can give us more information. So still shake in at this time. And if it's just silence, then come right on back. So KD2BHY with some delay. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay. Didn't come through the machine, but I heard somebody in the input say question. So wait about 4 or 5 seconds, and then questioner, give me your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your question. So wait about 5 seconds, the person who said question.
Okay. And to exchange. Now what I heard at first, there is no beep, but it's something like a ship, like something like that. That gives you determination when that repeater is recycling. So maybe you would be able to explain it better. Now my question is, what gives the speed and direction to the particles? And to exchange.
Yeah, Don, good question. They believe the Sporadic E cloud is somehow weather caused. In other words, there's an upper layer of the atmosphere where you've got two groups of air masses at slightly different altitudes moving in opposite directions. The layer between the two becomes unstable, develops something called Helmholtz instability. Somehow, maybe lightning gets excited. I'm not quite sure what all goes on, but somehow a Sporadic E cloud is created by these two shifting layers of air. That's one possible explanation. And for reasons that are not clear, I don't think Mel Wilson ever figured it out, why does the Sporadic E cloud, once it's formed, almost always move toward the northwest, almost always at roughly 150 miles an hour? That was what Mel Wilson was telling me when I met him at a VHF conference. That was what some of his research over much of a lifetime was telling him at the time, and I'm pretty sure he has written a couple of articles. So, in other words, the Sporadic E cloud appears not to be directly caused by the sun. It appears to be caused by some kind of unusual high atmosphere, rather violent weather condition. Maybe clear air turbulence. It's got something to do with it. So, the fact that it gets created at crazy times when the sunspot cycle is not favoring such things, the fact that it moves so fast, the fact that it's at the E layer in altitude, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it's 75 kilometers high, but it's good and high, and it gives you numbers like 1,500 miles of propagation capability. You can talk to a guy that many miles away with one single bounce off the Sporadic E clouds, and if you're a little bit lucky, you can get a double bounce if there happens to be a couple of clouds with the right setup. Occasionally, guys have got double-hop Sporadic E clouds between repeater.
Dick, WHCDL.
Yeah, go ahead, Andy. As you can tell, the machine's in a peculiar mode of operation. Andy, you got it. Andy, that whole last transmission of yours, I heard it on the input. None of it came through the machine. One of the things we seem to be finding is that when you drop a carrier, you've got to drop it for about 4 or 5 seconds. Otherwise, the machine will not pick up most of the time.
I got that already. So, did you copy what I said?
I sure did copy what you said. Looks like you and I have got to do a doubling if we really drop the machine. then you got to drop it for 5 seconds. Is that a normal?
No, no, it's not normal. You still hear me if I interrupt you?
I sure do hear you. So you're saying that that's not a normal known mode of operation?
No.
So what's the best explanation, Andy, as to why today we have to drop it?
I'm not sure yet. We're going to find out. We don't know. I can talk to you on the east input. I can go in on the east if you want to just talk to me there.
Okay. Now, the way you and I were just talking back and forth worked like a charm. I heard everything you said, and okay, the machine just came back. I copied everything you said on the input. None of it came through. What Andy was telling us to do is just to continue with the net. He's trying to get a hold of Bernie. They're trying to do a reset of the machine to get it back into normal operation. Did the clock get goofed up because the year changed, Andy? I mean, if we went from daylight saving time to
Dick?
Yes. Go ahead.
Stand by. We're going to do a reset on it. Stand by. Stand by. Don't transmit.
Roger, Dodger. We'll all keep quiet for a while.
RC2N repeater controller B5.282. Clock not set. Clock not set. Ready. Welcome to the W2. The time is 8:37 p.m. Sunday, January 1, 2012.
This is K2YO. Dick, can you come back now? K2RAW, K2YO, Dick, are you there?
I noticed that if I go to 147.375, I can get through. But right now, I'm not coming through on 2585.
That's incorrect, Dick. You are coming through on 850.
Yeah, I'm coming through because I'm transmitting on 975-375. If I go to 250 right now, I do not come through. Okay, right now I am.
Okay, we did a full reset, so the 250 input is working.
Bernie, you copy me? KC2WGP. I guess I just found out what the problem is. My machine flipped into another mode of operation where it changed the PL tone. Okay. Craziness. Alrighty. I think we're back in operation. So to complete what I was saying to James and to Wesley, the sporadic E-cloud, believe was of the opinion that it was a weather-caused condition, a violent upper atmosphere weather condition, not a normal solar event like a coronal mass expulsion or an extra burst of ultraviolet rays or whatever out of the sun. It looks like sporadic E has a very different causative agent, behaves rather differently as far as how big is the cloud, how fast it moves. Those are the things that are different. But the fact that it gives an extremely good reflection at much higher usable frequencies than normal for that part of the sunspot cycle or that part of the year is part of what's unusual about it. It's an extremely intense cloud of a rather small diameter.
The problem with that, because we're talking about the height of 70 kilometers, I wonder what is the density of the air at that particular height and what clouds are we talking about?
The normal weather clouds that you and I see usually are not more than 6 miles high. That's the troposphere. The ionosphere is much, much higher than the troposphere. So the word cloud, you have to be careful here now. The sporadic E cloud is not something you would see with your binoculars, your telescope, or if you're in an airplane. It's a clear air mass that is ionized. So the word cloud describes this layer of material that is radio reflective, but it's not a visually observable cloud. I wonder if that makes some sense. Wes, go ahead.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Thank you very much. So what is the air density, and how do you think that mechanism works like?
It is my belief that the air density in a sporadic E cloud and the air density normally at that altitude is not significantly different. There's something about the violent weather condition that these two, these upper very rapidly moving layers of air interacting in some kind of a way, maybe making static electricity, making lightning. That's one possible explanation for where all this ionization is coming from, the so-called Helmholtz instability, which is a kind of weather condition of two layers of air moving in opposite directions at slightly different altitudes, and the interface between them becomes unstable, probably generates static electricity when the moisture content is just right. That's a guess on my part, although there's very little moisture at these altitudes. So eventually we'll find out more about it. Now that we know that Mel Wilson did a lot of that research, we'll eventually find out his call letters. As I said, he's a silent key, but there's an award made in his honor at the Central States VHF Society. He was a prominent member of that organization, as well as the ham radio club that exists in the Rochester, New York area. He lived near Rochester, New York, and that's where I met him on that particular occasion, I guess about 15 or so years ago, while he was still doing some of that research. And he did publish a number of articles in QST as he was doing the research and making more findings. Part of the research he did was to take a map of, he took a map of the United States, and he knew where the broadcast stations are located. FM broadcast stations at 88 megacycles, we'll say, as well as channels 2, 4, and 5 broadcast stations. And by carefully tuning to those particular frequencies, knowing that the station was, let me pick a number, 1,200 miles away from him, where normal propagation would never get there. But once his receivers that were tuned to these various frequencies started picking up those particular broadcast stations, he would then know that some kind of a unusual propagation occurred. He then could look at the sequence of stations that he would be seeing as the cloud moved across the United States. Because the broadcast stations are on the air essentially 24 hours a day, very reliable and high power output, known locations, by figuring out what broadcast station you could hear from his home QTH in Rochester, New York, at what period of time, on what frequency, allowed to make some very good assumptions as to where the cloud was located, how moving, and roughly how big was the cloud itself. That was part of the method he was using for that research. Okay, Don, good question you asked there, James. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, thanks. That was very explanatory. Have you ever experienced sporadic E yourself?
Oh, yes. There was a sporadic E cloud that allowed me to communicate directly on 432 megacycles with a whole bunch of hams in Florida. I communicated with Bermuda on a sporadic E cloud. There are times when I've heard a lot of guys in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, real long distances that you normally don't hear on either 2 meters or 432, and a sporadic E cloud was doing that. Another very interesting propagation you'll eventually be finding out is aurora clouds. The aurora borealis. When you aim your antenna, if you've got a rotatable Yagi and you aim it to the north, there are times when an aurora is taking place, when you'll get a lot of reflection on 10 meters, 6 meters, and occasionally 2 meters, and I've heard reflections from the aurora on 432. And that's got some very unusual characteristics, which I'll be explaining probably next week, tell you a little bit more about aurora. But when it comes to VHF, UHF propagation, in the early days before ham radio operators started making a lot of experiments, let me drop. People really believed that the upper frequencies were only good for line-of-sight communication. And as the ham radio operators built equipment, started talking to each other at very long distances under certain conditions and studying what was going on. And there's things called trans-equatorial propagation, field aligned anomaly, sporadic E, aurora, forward propagated tropospheric scatter. There's a whole lot of crazy kinds of propagation. Super long ground wave, as it's sometimes called, but tropopropagation and super refraction is another one. When you get a layer of moist air close to the ground and drier air up high, as you tend to get when dew is forming on your grass at, let's say, midnight in the summertime, that layer of moist air down low has a higher dielectric constant because of the water. The wave propagates more slowly through the high humidity air than it does through the drier air up high. The net result is the wave gets bent downward. It doesn't move in a straight line. And when you get the right kind of a weather condition called super refraction, where the wave gets bent downward and it follows the curvature of the earth, you can be talking to a guy 600 miles away from you. He'll sound like he's in your backyard. You're talking to him on a VHF frequency. I mean, I'm on a 300-foot hill with a 100-foot of tower. My radio horizon out there is 40 miles. I used to hold contacts every Tuesday night with a guy in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away. So let me repeat that. My radio horizon is 40 miles away, and I'm talking to a man 480 miles away on single sideband on 432 for a half hour every Tuesday night, and I did that for 4.5 solid years. Put up a big enough antenna with a sensitive enough receiver. A big enough antenna, a sensitive enough receiver, good aiming of those antennas, well-equipped stations on both sides, and what's the maximum range you can operate on VHF, UHF? Not clear, as you can tell. It's a matter of having the right hardware, the right technique, and there's all kinds of crazy methods that that signal can propagate. Radio propagation is something that people have spent a lifetime studying, and they know after the end of that lifetime, like Mel Wilson's study of sporadic E-clouds, he knew a lot more. He knew he didn't have the whole story. That what Mother Nature is doing there is a lot more complicated than first meets the eye. You could philosophically say that this world was not set up for us to be easy to understand. It's quite a challenge. And so, on a quick break, back to you, James. What's your next antenna going to be, and what's the next mode of operation you intend to go into? You've got a handy talkie, and you're about to put more antennas on it, if I know you. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right. Hopefully, next mode of operation will be SSB on the HF band. Hopefully, if I get my general. But next antenna, probably an external Yagi.
Okay, that's a very good way to go. The Yagi itself can be anything from $5 to $500. The $5 Yagi, you can build it out of coat hanger wire and strips of wood, and you can get a beautiful article on how to do that, a very high performance 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 element Yagi on 2 meters or 440 megacycles by going to the website of Kent Britain, Whiskey Alpha 5. VictorJulietBravo.com. I'll repeat that. www.WhiskeyAlpha5VictorJulietBravo.com. You go to that website, and he's got some articles on how to build Yagi antennas, high-performance Yagi antennas out of coat hanger wire. And they've won antenna contests from time to time, antenna gain contests. So the antenna doesn't have to be expensive. The rotator you put under it allows you to aim it in various directions. And whether or not you set up one horizontal to talk to the sideband people and one vertical to talk to the repeater people, that's your choice, or the antenna you're listening to right now. Mine is a 14-element Yagi, which is slanted at a 45-degree angle in polarization. So in other words, the boom is parallel to the ground, but all the elements are rotated 45 degrees compared to the ground. So I'm halfway between horizontal polarization and vertical polarization. That allows me to talk to both groups of people with the same Yagi. And I'm 3 dB down from each, but the Yagi supposedly has 14 dB of gain, and that's a good sacrifice, 15 dB of gain, something like that. So you do get a lot of performance out of a Yagi. It's the biggest bang for the dollar, in my opinion, as long as it's reasonably well-tuned. And you follow somebody's good design, and well-tuning it is just a matter of making some accurate measurements with a ruler. So good.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So good luck with that project, Jim. And come back to him from time to time and tell us how it's going and what you're doing. Sounds like you're moving pretty fast for a guy that's only been around for a short period of time. Now, it was a little bit difficult before for people to sign in because of the way the machine was behaving. Now that the machine is back into normal operation, is there anyone else who wanted to check in during the first hour and didn't get a chance to do so? Please give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Number 2, Victor United, United, Frank, Foxtrot, Romeo, Alpha, November, Kilo, in Bohemia. Hi, Dick. How you doing? I've listened to you for the last 10 or 12 years. Go ahead.
Okay, I think that was November 2, Victor, United, United, Frank, and I think you said you're in Bohemia, and Fox November 30, that's where I live, that's the grid square. And so, Frank, do you have a question tonight? And sounds like you've been listening for a while. I don't know if you've checked in very many times. What would you like to ask us tonight? You've got it, Frank.
And WS2N with the space report there.
Very glad, Paul. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, NW2NN, I think it was. Oh, nothing in particular. I built the last 22 years more antennas and gave them away than I could count. I just listened to you for some more technical stuff. I'll let the other fellow pick it up with a break in there. Sounds pretty important.
That was Paul telling us that he does have a space report. So, you sure you don't have a question, Frank? What kind of antennas were you building and giving away? Were you the local Elmer in your area of Bohemia? Is that what you're saying, Frank? Go ahead.
You might say that. I learned that from another Elmer. He was 7580 at the time, worked in Rocky Point. You know, transfer station, Rocky Point, my old friend Bill, W2WDW. Just about everybody on Earth knew him. And he taught me as I was growing up. But I showed him the antennas. He showed me everything else. I built the Yagis, horizontal, vertical, V-quads, loop antennas on 2 meters on 440. I did some uplink, downlink. It didn't work out too well. I had both antennas pretty good, the uplink and the downlink. I think at the time it was 2 meters 440 or 2 meters 10 meters. I didn't catch it coming up right. I had too many things to do. So I caught part of it once. Wire antennas, I couldn't tell you how many. It's just the part of the hobby that fascinated me beyond description. I just couldn't stop building them. I would run on my roof all the time. Let me unfee a second. On my roof in Holbrook, where I used to live, I now live in Bohemia. I had about 80 antennas. I had problems with the neighbors after a while. I said, you know what? I tested more antennas than I caught to have liver pills, and I gave most of them away. I think I'm done. So nowadays, I just listen to a new interesting concept on an antenna. And a lot of times, mostly all the time, I'm listening to you. I don't always break in. I've been listening to you for about 12, 14, 15 years, it could be. And I've been on this frequency a lot back then. And that's about the whole 9 yards of it. I'd say I was the Elmer. I learned on my own, and I learned by reading books and listening to you, Brad.
Lots of good information there, Frank. And you are also reconfirming what I've said for a long time, and that is, if you really want an antenna engineer, there's a high probability you've got to hire a ham radio operator, a serious, enthusiastic ham radio operator. The schools do a fairly poor job of teaching it. The books do a fairly poor job of teaching it. And you'd be amazed how many people working for the antenna department of a good company that has sitting on their shelf the ARRL antenna book, and sometimes they've got it turned around backwards so you can't see what it is. They're not willing to admit that that's one of their most used books, as opposed to some of the highfalutin books that they were supposedly using in college, which give them a lot of fancy equations, but they're not necessarily practical. The way we teach radio science, wireless engineering, boy, there's a huge disconnect between it and the way it's practiced in the real world. I've been doing consulting work with reference to antennas now, solidly for the last 9 or so years, and I can tell you that finding antenna engineers with good practical experience is fairly difficult. Let me drop. And the way an antenna really works, where all that gain is coming from, where all that bandwidth is coming from, is not easy to understand. The way it's explained in most of the books is fairly poor. One of the people I work with, one of the supervisors at a company I often work with, had me over the Christmas holiday writing up a report explaining how circular polarization works, because for a number of reasons he needed that particular information, and the books just didn't explain it to him. When I talk to a new graduate from a bachelor's school or a master's school in electrical engineering, and I'm interviewing them, and ask them how many kinds of antennas are there, it's one of the questions I like to ask. And quite often they'll say, oh, there's about 20 or 30 different ways you can set up a piece of wire and make an antenna. I say, really? You open up the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the fourth edition by Vlasic, or the third edition by Johnson, or the second edition by Johnson and Jasek, or the first one by Jasek. I worked with Jasek. He used to be the president of the Jasek Antenna Engineering Company. And so you look at the 50 or so chapters in that book, and you'll find out there are approximately 5,000 kinds of antennas. And you think, well, that's the end of the story. I have filed a whole bunch of patents in the last 8 years or so on so-called new antennas. And one of them was a drastic modification of a Yagi antenna, invented in 1928 by Mr. Yagi in Japan. And I guess it was around 2003 or so, I filed a patent on a new kind of a Yagi. And the patent was granted. So you haven't heard the end of the story on antennas. I can tell that you've developed a real hobby.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you guys can tell, we've got to wait 4 or 5 seconds for all four beeps to really fully reset the machine. It's too bad, Frank, that your neighbors are giving you flack on the antennas. Is that also true of Bohemia, or could you go back to it? It sounds like you really enjoy it, and I think you want to go back to it. I bet there's a way you can work out an agreement with your neighbors where they allow you to put up your antennas, as many of them you want, on your roof. What do you think, Frank? I think it's November 2, Victor Uniform, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
K2YO, housekeeping issue when you get done with Frank.
Roger.
Okay, acknowledged. See, I'm not in Hoboken anymore. I don't have that one nasty neighbor, retired cop. But if a leaf went in his pool for my yard, he'd complain. He was just a born complainer. If there was nothing to complain about, he wasn't happy. But I got past him. I told him what I thought, and I told him what I'm doing. I told him I work along with the FCC and ARRL when I have to. And I got paperwork, and I had to show him why it's legal. And then the whole 9 yards. And trying to explain some technical stuff to a neighbor that knows nothing about radio, except you press a button, you talk, and you hear a voice on the other side. It'll give you a migraine headache, but I test it out to all the neighbors. He's the only one that complained. I finally drove it into his head, and he finally became a friend of mine. But I have to use psychology. I already took psychology years ago. I'm 68, so I've been around a while. I had psychology classes. I worked for Central Islip Psychiatric Center, Pilgrim State Psychiatric Center, and I knew how to handle it. It's a matter of psychology, and I won. Over here, they give me no problem whatsoever. All the neighbors are very helpful, very friendly. They don't care if you put up a wire. They don't care if you put up a tower, as long as you talk to the person who runs the area. I live in a very large trailer park, 400 homes. I have no problems whatsoever from any of the neighbors, except people who understand, and I get them to understand, and they're fine with it. And how do you like that?
Wow. Well done. Well done that you can take a one of these real curmudgeons, a guy that's going to be mad at everything, and turn them around. That's what it takes. You know, we ham radio operators, we are, unfortunately, the second-class citizens. The reason I say that is because, well, let me let Bernie give us his point of order, or his with the information he needs us. Go ahead, Bernie. K2YO, K2YIW.
Evening, Dick. Sorry, I didn't want to slow down the conversation. We've only got a single beep tonight, the way that we had to reset the controller to get you back on the air. We're not in net mode. The implications of that are you have a single beep instead of the four, and probably PL tones are required rather than turn PLs off. But that was the quickest way to get you back on the air tonight. K2YO clear.
Yeah, I certainly can tell the PL tones are required because when I did something crazy with my machine here, which I had to do some resetting, where it lost the particular PL tone and put in another one, and I wasn't coming through, and I eventually figured out what was going on, because you guys are getting through and I wasn't. Okay, so for those who, quite often, this particular TechNet, the PL tone requirement is turned off on this machine, and therefore anybody can check in. Tonight, though, it looks like PL tone is required. I'm going to try a quick experiment to confirm that. Sure enough, I turned off my PL tone, it didn't come through. So you have to have a 136.5 hertz PL tone, private line, or STCSS, you know what I mean, CTCSS tone, in order to get through this machine. Yeah, that's very good that you turned that guy around, Frank. Very smart. When it comes to ham radio operators, there's roughly one of them per 500 in the general population. We may not think so because we keep talking to our fellow ham radio operators, but in the real world, we are the oddballs. We are the crazy people. We are the strange ones. One per 500 in the general population, that is what, 0.5% of the general population of ham radio operators. Therefore, you could say that 99.5% of the population is not going to understand us. They think that they think radio is dangerous. They think RF radiation creates cancer. Oh, terrible. You guys have heard me say that for a whole lot of time. We are the educated ones. We know that radio is our friend. We know that it is the friendliest thing as all hell. It's been around, studied very seriously for 60 solid years by the American National Standards Institute, a division of the IEEE Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. So our best colleges, universities, institutions, fancy companies and whatever, have been studying radio and the effects on human beings for more than 60 years. And that report, the C95 report of the IEEE, which is called American National Standards Institute, ANSI, ANSI report, that report is the defining document for the United States, for the Department of Defense, and NIOSH and OSHA and whatever. And it said that when a organization, like, say, for instance, Hempstead Town, came up with a rule saying that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hempstead Town came up with a recent ruling 6 months or so ago saying that all new cell sites have to be 500 feet away from schools, places of worship, and private homes, which means everywhere is outlawed. Craziness. Where that rule, where the 500-foot number come from is a rabbit hat trick. And I'm extremely disappointed that Huntington Town decided to copy that particular zoning law, that particular ordinance, that particular moratorium on new cell sites. Thorough misunderstanding. I could tell that none of those people have read that report, that understand the main defining document. They just sat there and didn't give the population, their constituency, what they need. They gave them what they want. The population thinks that they don't want any more cell sites. They think that they're bad. They don't realize they're saving lives. So we ham radio operators are going to have to educate people on this strongly misunderstood area. And so the antennas you're going to be building and putting back on your roof there of your trailer in Bohemia is going to get you back into the hobby that you really enjoyed, Frank. And I guarantee you can use your psychology on those trailer park neighbors and convince them that you're the local lightning arrester and that you're going to be protecting them.